prepared a lot of use of the data that you've so kindly provided to your students, colleagues, and the community at large. Now's your chance to tell us if we got it right or not. But where's your slide?
I was going to just spend the time rebutting the previous comments. I thought about doing that, but I thought I'd rise above it. I'll take the high road. I will make a couple of comments. First of all, I appreciate everyone for coming, certainly my students. It's, as I said earlier, one of the great pleasures for me has been to deal with a very large group of very bright young scientists, and it's great to see all of you. I would also like a quick comment. I have benefited greatly from a number of mentors, beginning with Hugh Kiefer, who had a huge impact on me, followed by Ron Greeley, who I had the pleasure of doing a postdoc with for a few years. Ray Arvidson and Hap McSween have also had a huge impact on me as mentors, and it's fabulous that all four of you are here. I learned a great deal from all of them. I learned a great deal from Ron. One of the things that I learned was how to give a good talk, and I'm going to violate all those rules. Ron taught me one slide per minute, and I think I have three. But anyway, we'll try. So I want to do a couple of things. One of the things I wanted to actually touch on a bit of history and remind us of where we are. When I began in this field, Mars was a point of light in the night sky. We knew it was red. We knew some very basic things about it. This is a drawing, not from my little telescope, but from someone else's larger telescope. But literally, we knew Mars had bright regions and dark regions and red stuff and brown stuff and white stuff. And as a budding geologist, I found that frustrating. So I've spent a lot of time trying to provide us more information. There's been a huge history, beginning with Tom McCord and many of his students and colleagues, people looking at Mars with a telescope, discovered that there was the red edge and there was hints of iron mineralogy, hints of OH, hints of hematite. This is an image from Hugh Kiefer's IRTM, and it was a 20 micron emissivity image, which one could say is the blame for us being here today. That instrument showed that there was indeed emissivity information on the surface of Mars, and we used that to argue successfully for tests and to go forward. There was early spacecraft observations. This is from Beebring et al.'s ISM instrument, near-infrared, that showed there were water features, there were pyroxene band depths, and more importantly, they varied with spatially across the surface. So there was information to be had from spectroscopy. Some people, Jeff, even tried to look at Mars in the infrared. It's a hard thing to do. Again, showing that there was information there, that there was spatial and spectral variability that warranted future exploration. We've seen a lot of this today. I'll just put it up to remind us that the next step along the way was the TESS, which operated for a decade. And we acquired several hundred million spectra, and those have been deconvolved and made into wonderful maps. So we were beginning to say, why was Mars red? What was it made of? What were the minerals that were there? That followed by the Themis instrument, which had, as Hugh pointed out earlier, very high spatial resolution. And we began to see, we couldn't say quite as well what the material was, but we could certainly start to see the patterns. And I felt that at this point we were doing geology. We were seeing spectral variations, compositional variations on the scale of geologic processes. We weren't talking about continental-sized dust deposits or continental-sized dark regions, but actually we're finally beginning to do geology at this point. That's been followed up with the Mars Express Omega data, which provides a very different way of looking at the planet. We've seen some of these images before today. And again, confirming that there were pyroxene differences and other differences. I'll come back to talk about more Omega data in a bit. And then finally, the spectacular CRISM data that have shown now at tens of meter scales remarkable variations in surface compositions. So what is the point of this little stroll through history? The point is, in our lifetime, in our professional careers, we've gone from Mars as a red spot in the night sky to doing geology and asking very sophisticated questions about the planet Mars. And it's been spectacular to have been a part of that evolution and that discovery. I think there's still a lot of really important questions. I think we're still discussing the volcanic history of Mars. What has been and is the role of water? These are questions we asked 20 years ago. We have the data now to really explore them in great detail. What's the diversity of environments on the surface of Mars? And I'll come back to talk about it at the end. And extremely important, where are the best places for future exploration and for eventual sample returns? I think as a Mars community, this last point here, future exploration and sample return, are things that we all want to keep in mind. Volcanic Mars, I couldn't resist a few comments. I'm a smart guy. I test type 1 I've labeled as basalt. Test type 2 I've left unlabeled. I think it's been a very enjoyable 10-year discussion and debate. What is test type 2? And I think we've come a very long way in suggesting that perhaps it's like many controversies, it's a combination of things. There was probably an original volcanic differences in those terrains, and there's also been surface alteration. The point of this, though, is we've come a long ways from that original test type 1, test type 2. Vicky showed this earlier, but I wanted to emphasize it. The original maps of Banfield and all were continuing, like all good data sets. It's a rich data set, and we're continuing to make advances. And Vicky pointed out how she and Will are advancing our understanding of the mineralogy and petrology of the surface of Mars. Not only getting a better handle on what's there, but doing a much better job of combining these different data sets, the long wave and the short wave IR, trying to reconcile the differences, recognizing that they're both telling us extremely important things. And so I think there's been a lot of progress, and there's still a lot of work to be done in this area. We've, with Themis, found some remarkable things. This is some olivine-rich basalts in Ganges chasma. And as Mike and Hep talked about today, there's a lot of debate still about what's been the history of olivine on the surface of Mars. But we're seeing spatial layers, true layers, that extend huge distances that have mineralogic differences. Is that a primary volcanic effect? If it's a secondary weathering effect, that's just as interesting. Why did this particular layer's olivine get left behind where the olivine above and below it has been dissolved? This is a blow-up. That's the region we were just looking at. This is an enhancement down here. These olivine deposits can be traced several thousand kilometers. They form a nearly single layer. They're telling us something remarkable about the igneous petrology and igneous history of this planet. What produced these olivine-rich layers, or alternatively, what produced the alteration of everything around it, leaving behind these olivine-rich layers? Either case, wonderful data, fascinating problems. As been mentioned a couple of times, we found a variety of N-member diverse compositions on Mars, dacites that we see as spectral units in Themis that we can actually tell their composition in TESS. I think we didn't plan it this way, but you couldn't have found a better combination of high spectral resolution, 3-kilometer mapping, followed by low spectral resolution, 100-meter mapping. I think it's actually worked out better than if you had a single hyperspectral instrument that could do both, because the data volume from that would have been phenomenal. Now we've used Themis very effectively to find places of interest and then go back and look at them with TESS. So the combination of those two, again, has been probably one of the most satisfying things in my professional career at watching the synergy of these two instruments evolve as people begin to use them. And what we found is, in localized regions, has been talked about, there's this remarkable diversity of igneous compositions. Are these important spatially and geologically? Probably not. But they do point to processes that say, in many ways, at small scales, processes on Mars are very similar to processes on the Earth. This is work from Deanne Rogers' dissertation, which I think is just beginning to really be fully utilized and appreciated and mapped, where she showed that there are spatial differences in mineralogy, plagioclase, high calcium, low calcium pyroxenes. This is what I set out to accomplish 20 years ago, was to provide the data that forced the petrologist to think hard about mantle processes, volcanic centers, evolution of composition with time. I am a believer in surface alteration, but I also believe that these spatial patterns are telling us something about the evolution of igneous processes on Mars as well, and we shouldn't forget about them. Couple quick slides on wet versus dry Mars, because I think that's really where life gets interesting. There's plenty of evidence for water on Mars. There's lots and lots of channels. One of the things that's amazed me, and those of you who know me know I'm a dry Mars kind of guy, but every single Themis image we've ever taken has a channel in it somewhere. And at some point, you have to recognize that water, ice, volatiles have played a major role in the evolution of that surface. And the mineral data is, again, telling us a couple different stories. This is, again, comparing the early work of olivine mapping with some of the more recent work of olivine mapping. Either way, there's a lot of olivine present on the surface of Mars. Now, some of it may have been weathered away, but there's still an awful lot left. And so whatever alteration processes have occurred, I think we have to keep in mind that Mars is still fundamentally a dry place. And the Omega data are contributing to that. We're seeing all of these wavelengths, all of these instruments are saying Mars has been a pretty dry place. On the other hand, the mineralogy is also saying locally Mars has been a very wet place. Hopefully we're all familiar with the hydration data from Omega and the phyllosilicate maps from Omega. Locally, there's clearly been alteration and weathering going on. In places like Neely Fossae, this is a site that Jack Mustard and his colleagues have been proposing for MSL. In one place, we find olivines, pyroxenes, phyllosilicates, saying, again, Mars is a volcanic planet, but locally it's had a lot of aqueous processes. And I think it's incumbent upon us to really try to understand those aqueous processes. This is a slide from Jack's talk of a few weeks ago at the MSL workshop. And what strikes me is the spatial relationships, the close proximity of unweathered olivine and pyroxene with phyllosilicates. I think that's important. I really don't think we fully understand that. I think it's crucial to our understanding of early Mars. And I think to me then the question, a key question is, what was the origin and duration of these wet periods in early Mars? We know they're early because this was affecting the ancient crater terrain. Are wet climates required? Okay, are long-lived subsurface heat sources the answer? Could ejecta from basin-forming impacts have melted ground ice and produced local, short-lived groundwater systems? I'm in this camp at the moment that I think this impact-related mechanism can explain some of the observations. Clearly, basin impacts had to be an important process on early Mars. I think one of the things we as Martian scientists do is we forget that. We haven't spent a lot of time thinking about where is that basin ejecta. It's been noted that the early phyllosilicate formation ended before the end of heavy bombardment. So it was a very early phase. It wasn't something that came after end of bombardment. It was occurring and ending before the bombardment ended. And I think this type of a model could explain the close proximity of unaltered olivine and heavily altered basalts and phyllosilicate-bearing units. They're once, if they were related to impact process, those impact units will cool, and subsequent lava flows or preceding lava flows would never have seen the impact of that. No pun intended. So the point here is I think we found a lot of interesting processes related to water, but we have a long ways to go. So this is my take on wet versus dry. Mechanical weathering is orders of magnitude faster than chemical weathering. So I think the massive amounts of channeling and morphology that we see could be produced in relatively rapidly during short time intervals of a wet environment. Chemical weathering is inherently slower, certainly on a cold, frozen planet, and I think as a result of that, it tends to be localized and relatively minor, and the water that we see, while important, may have been short-lived and fleeting. And I think, as I'll come back to it, my last slide, it's easy to forget that at times and focus too heavily on the role of water. It's certainly sexy and exciting, but Mars has a lot more to offer. I'd like to conclude just a couple of comments from actual new science and results. This is the location of these salt sites that Jeff referred to just a moment ago, mapped by this paper that Mickey Osterloo, one of Vicky's students, led. And the important point is there's lots of these. There's several hundred of them. They're not rare. If we look at these, this is an example. They show up in a particular color in the Themis multispectral imagery. They form in basins with channels flowing into them. I think that's extremely important. I want to show a quick example of one of my recent famous favorites. There's one here just to the west of the famous hematite deposits. It's at the equator. And if we look at that, it's also in a closed basin. Here you can see the Themis color image, the multispectral IR, superimposed on a variety of imagery. If we zoom in and look at that, this is a high-rise view of that. We colorize that with the Themis data. These salt deposits are beautifully correlated with morphologies. And if we look at that in a little more detail, this is a region at the upper end of this 5 kilometer or 10 kilometer sized playa. You can see this beautiful relationship between the salt bearing units that have a unique texture that are being exposed by erosion from underneath this overlying region. If you look in even closer, you can see this pretty remarkable fracture pattern, jointing pattern in these chloride-bearing units. These are important. They're meters thick. They're extensive. They're common. We need to really think about them. I put this slide up not to talk about it, but just to say, yeah, I haven't forgotten about mini tests, and I apologize, Steve. I just didn't have time to say much more. But mini tests has told us a tremendous amount as well, including other types of environments that are glassy or silica-rich or, you know, there's other assemblies. Last couple of comments. The thing we've learned in the last decade is Mars has a diversity of aqueous environments. Massive phyllosilicates, layered phyllosilicates, the hematite sulfate units, layered morphology units, these salt-bearing units, high silica units, both hydrated and unhydrated, gypsum deposits. We're no longer talking about was Mars wet or dry, but we have a huge range of environments to go explore. So two summary slides. First of all, to remind ourselves, our knowledge of Martian mineralogy and petrology, I want to keep emphasizing that, has improved unbelievably over the last 15 years. I think we even forget about that. Mars has is fundamentally a volcanic planet with diverse compositions. Clays, sulfates, carbonates that I didn't mention, high silica phases, hematite, chloride salts have been detected and mapped. All of these are telling the story of aqueous processes through time. So on this dry volcanic planet, there are these oases of truly remarkable processes that have gone on. So to conclude, this is where I think we need to be going in the next 10 years. I think we need to continue to send these rovers to explore these diverse mineralogic sites. We have far more to choose from now than we have rovers to send. MSL cannot be the last rover. We have to keep going to more of these places. There's too much going on, too much potential difference in pH and composition and chemistry and oxygen fugacity in those waters. Mars has a lot of diverse places to explore. I believe that composition should remain the primary driver in selecting these future landing sites. Okay, we know enough about composition now to really argue amongst ourselves about what are the best of these environments to go explore. And a final comment, understanding the role of water is crucial, but I think it's also equally crucial that we do not lose sight of the larger geologic context provided by the complete mineralogy and petrology of Mars. I think oftentimes we talk about the phyllosilicate units and forget that that might be a handful of percent phyllosilicate in a rich volcanic rock. And if we don't keep remembering the bigger picture, the larger overall mineralogy and the overall context of Mars, I think we'll make mistakes in interpreting these environments and interpreting the places that we're going. So to conclude, for me it's been a fantastic 15 years working with all of you. I hope to continue to work on these problems. And I think the future is remarkably bright from the data we have, the data we'll get, and the understanding that you will provide to these data sets to really understand the rich history, the geologic history of the planet Mars. So thank you very much. And I will take the opportunity to rebut and critique many of the comments that have been made throughout the afternoon over the next hour and a half.
Okay. All right. We have time for a couple of questions or comments for Phil. Well, Phil, yeah. I understand that you have transitioned to a Scotch drinker.
This is true.
And I have to point out that when Phil first came to ASU, his favorite beverage was cheap Mexican brandy. So with this note, I think they're going to set the bar up very soon. And we've had a wonderful series of talks this afternoon, and Herb and I thank the speakers for sharing their results with us, drawing on the data that Phil has provided. We will have the G.K. Gilbert Award citation and award presentation at 5:45, I believe it is. And so there is supposed to be a bar back there soon.
Yes,
if not right now.
Is that they're probably going to wheel something in and put it up against the back wall. And there should be 15 or 10 minutes for you to get something and talk amongst yourselves before we actually
introduce. Please share a drink with among ourselves, and we'll reconvene at 5:45.
Great summary.
Great summary.
Congratulations.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.